From Foreign Policy, I'm Sarah Wildman, and this is First Person. This week, why unrest in Kashmir threatens the Indian subcontinent. The Himalayan region of Jammu and Kashmir is known for breathtaking mountain views and continuous military presence. When the British left India after 200 years in 1947, they made a fateful decision, redrawing the map with most Muslims in Pakistan and most Hindus in India. But much of majority Muslim Kashmir remained in India. That arrangement was always an uncomfortable one. Though Kashmir was given special semi-autonomous status, over the years the area has been the epicenter of regional unrest and a focal point for the lingering animosity between Pakistan and India. Two wars between these two countries have played out in Kashmir. This summer, there has been a major shift in the status quo. On August 5th, the Indian government abruptly suspended Kashmir's autonomy. Kashmiri politicians were detained. Communications were shut off. The internet went dark. Cell phones became useless. And landlines were cut.
There's been an atmosphere of confusion since last night. The internet was suspended and then our mobiles stopped working. We're unable to call our families to tell them what's happened. They must be feeling tense.
Now the region is in limbo. Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi has rejected offers of mediation assistance from the Trump administration. And Pakistan is furious. In August, the country's prime minister said India's suspension of Kashmir's autonomy threatens to tip the region into a nuclear dispute. India's Supreme Court is currently hearing arguments about the legality of Modi's move. But how that will all play out is anyone's guess. To learn more, I spoke to Barkha Dutt, an Indian broadcast journalist who has covered Kashmir extensively.
Well, so we actually want to go back to the beginning of August a little bit with you. Since you've been on the ground in Kashmir several times over the course of the month, I'd like us to start with just before Article 370 was suspended. What was happening in Kashmir at the time?
Well, I think before the Modi government took the decision to actually suspend Article 370, which in simple terms means that this was a state that enjoyed a kind of special place in the Indian Union. And with the withdrawal of this article, the special place has gone. Life was sort of unremarked on, if I could describe it that way, in Jammu and Kashmir. Now, what I mean by that is that the insurgency, of course, in the Kashmir Valley is now almost 29 years old. And so, to an extent, the Indian mind space is used to phases of violence, phases of turmoil, clashes between protesters and security personnel, a line of control that can often be tense as there are standoffs that take place with the Pakistan military, which India has long accused of pushing in terrorists across both the international border and the line of control that separates the our part of Kashmir from what India calls Pakistan-occupied Kashmir. So to that extent, Indians and the Indian media is used to phases of trouble in Jammu and Kashmir. So it's not that there was anything big happening except for something called the Amarnath Yatra, which is an annual pilgrimage that takes place in Jammu and Kashmir every year. It's actually a very sort of sacred moment for Hindus who travel from all parts of the country to undertake this pilgrimage. And this pilgrimage was abruptly called off. And the government said that there was concerns that there was a danger of a terror threat. And that's when everybody started wondering, okay, is there something big about to happen? Because tourists were asked to evacuate and we were told that there was a real danger of a possible terrorist strike on this yatra or Hindu pilgrimage that takes place every year.
And there was a buildup at the same time of the Indian security forces on the ground?
Yes, it was conceded that there were extra troops sent in. Those extra troops, at that time, we thought was because there was an anticipation of this terrorist strike on this pilgrimage. But later, one can connect the dots and think that since Article 370 was going to be withdrawn and there was anticipation of both internal turmoil as well as perhaps external violence from Pakistan, therefore there needed to be extra troops on the ground.
Now, Article 370.
Yes.
Can you just explain for our listeners exactly what sort of autonomy did it grant Kashmir?
Well, Article 370 in its original form, and I say original form because over the years, successive governments in Delhi have actually eroded different sort of privileges that this article gave to the state of Jammu and Kashmir. So just for background, Jammu and Kashmir was a kingdom. It was governed by a king, Maharaja Hari Singh. Maharaja Hari Singh had the right to choose whether he wanted to be part of India or Pakistan when the British were forced to leave and Pakistan was born from India and there were two separate nations. And basically, the Maharaja signed an instrument of accession, which later, by the way, gave way to Article 370. So Article 370 did not come immediately. The instrument of accession gets signed at this point and basically, in its original purest form, says that Jammu and Kashmir will have the right to make its legislate its own laws on all areas except defense, external affairs, communication, and finance. Over the years, however, it kept getting whittled down, you know, and chipped at, and as a lot of these privileges that existed kept going away. And so a lot of people in India actually believe that the article in any case was in some ways, it had more symbolic value than actual value.
So we described the pulling out of all the tourists just before the abrogation of Article 370. Was there tension or anxiety on the ground in Kashmir as that began to happen?
So I think there was a lot of anxiety and there was a lot of speculation. And I think a lot of the anxiety and the speculation was born from the fact that people did not know exactly what was going to happen. And I just think that the historicity of this is important to understand. And I just wanted to sort of make a slight correction on the dates. 1947 was when the king signed the instrument of accession. Article 370, as I said, was actually negotiated by Sheikh Abdullah, who was probably the tallest political leader of Jammu and Kashmir, and that came a few years later. I had a number of friends on the ground in the Kashmir Valley in particular who were very, very tense about what was happening. A number of people thought that there was another law, it's called Article 35A, that is what was going to be scrapped. Now, Article 35A basically meant that the only people who could buy land in Jammu and Kashmir were people who were state residents. And in this way, there are only a handful of states in India which actually have this privilege. Now, one of the reasons that this article was criticized is because Kashmiri women or women of the state who married outside did not have equal rights as men who married outside. So it was a gender unequal law. Nobody thought that Article 370 would go because people thought that that needed a much more elaborate legal process, including the consent of the elected members of Jammu and Kashmir. Now, I know this is getting a bit complicated, but it's important to understand that at the moment, there was no elected assembly in Jammu and Kashmir, and there was what is called governor's rule. What this means is that the central government had its own representative, the governor, and his consent was taken as the consent of the state. And that is the legal point on which the Supreme Court will now have to decide whether this withdrawal can stand the legal scrutiny and test or not. So many big changes happened at the same time in one fell swoop. Article 35A went. Article 35A not just prevented gender equality, but it also prevented refugees who had settled for many, many years from West Pakistan, but were not regarded as state subjects. These people did not have voting rights. The state had three regions, the regions of Jammu, Kashmir, and Ladakh. Ladakh was now made into what's called a union territory, which is a smaller nomenclature of a full state, and Jammu and Kashmir remained one state. So the bifurcation was another big change. And then Jammu and Kashmir itself was, in a sense, demoted to the status of a union territory with the promise that when things settle down, it will be brought back to the level of a full state again. So four dramatic changes took place in one go. There were these cataclysmic changes that took place all together, and it did take place without the opposition having any idea, and almost immediately phone, internet lines going down in Jammu and Kashmir, and an enhanced sort of security scenario where there was a clampdown on movement, and almost immediately you had thousands of people, in fact, being detained as well. So all of this literally happened together.
Now tell me about what happened on the street once Article 370 and 35A and all these cataclysmic events take place together, was it clear immediately what was happening?
So I was able to visit a couple of days after this announcement was made. And I think what we saw was a clampdown in terms of phone lines not working at all. Now, I've been going to Jammu and Kashmir for many, many years, and it's not unusual that in times of turmoil or expected turmoil, you do have phone lines and the internet lines in particular snap down. The internet lines are considered a big problem by security agencies because in the past, social media has literally been weaponized by militant groups and used to spread all kinds of rumors or radicalized messages. But what I have almost never seen shut down are landlines. And this time you had cellular services, landline, fixed line services, as well as the internet shut down. You had a curfew more strictly imposed in the problem areas or some of the more sensitive areas of the city, not as strictly imposed in other parts of the city. You had all shops and establishments shut. And this is how it was. Kashmir is like a pressure cooker. There's a tight lid on it. And we're not going to actually get to know the full impact of this till this lid is actually lifted. And whatever's beneath, we have to see, is it simmering or is it going to boil over? And I think that what's also happening is that more than 370, the clampdown is really making people anxious and angry. So right now, we have to separate these strands of anger. Is the anger because people, children can't reach their parents because, you know, I've met somebody whose wedding was cancelled. I've met somebody who sort of broke down in tears because he couldn't reach his mother for over 3 weeks, who was, you know, not keeping good health. I met an old man who broke down crying because he was trying to reach his son who works abroad. And it's very difficult to separate the strands of anger from the anger that is simply to that sort of visceral anxiety over not being able to communicate or express yourself and the anger over 370. And I think we have to separate, you know, it's going to take us time to separate these strands.
We'll be right back. Hey, podcast listeners, it's 2019 and there's a lot going on in the world. Trade wars, street protests, multiple ongoing refugee crises. It can be hard to get past the noise and understand it all. That's why I turn again and again to the podcast Global Dispatches. The host, Mark Leon Goldberg, he has some smart conversations with some of the most well-informed experts in the foreign policy world, from leaders like former New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark to on-the-ground activists in countries from Sudan to Myanmar. I know if you're a fan of First Person, you'll enjoy Global Dispatches too. Have a listen. Information blackouts and cutting the internet has been a strategy, as you just explained, to exert control and tamp down dissent. Do you think that's going to continue? Is it viable?
So let me give you the perspective of what the administration and what the police say on the ground. They tell us about a time in 2016 when there was a local militant called Burhan Wani, a Kashmiri militant who was eliminated in an anti-terrorism operation. What happened after this was that Wani had used social media to acquire a kind of cult status among a younger generation of Kashmiri separatists. And the government at that time was a little bit sort of not very strict about the kind of restrictions it initially imposed. And it allowed Burhan Wani's funeral to take place. And we had like, you know, thousands and hundreds of thousands of people attending that. And there were other militant funerals that were permitted. And these funerals became, according to the police, literally a recruiting ground for new militants. And what happened is that within 1 week of Burhan Wani, this militant, being eliminated, you had 37 casualties in the Kashmir Valley, 22 of which took place in the first 48 hours. What police and the administration told me when I would repeatedly quiz them about these restrictions was that our priority was to not have any deaths, that our first priority was to learn from the mistakes we made at that time and decide that it was a reasonable trade-off if we were going to clamp down on certain freedoms if it meant that nobody was going to die. So that is their explanation. Is it viable? My personal opinion is that It's certainly not desirable. Let me say that in an ideal world and in a democracy like ours, I can understand that there were law and order considerations that made the administration do this in the immediate aftermath. But I think it is time to now start easing and lifting these restrictions. And in particular, I do believe that India has made a strong case with the American president, Donald Trump. You may have seen those pictures at the White House where basically India told Trump, lay off. This is our own issue. We don't need you to mediate. The prime minister made a very, very pointed trip to Islamic countries in the Gulf region, including Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates, sending Pakistan a message that you can't make this a Hindu-Muslim issue, that just because Jammu and Kashmir was India's, is India's only Muslim-majority state, don't think you can Islamize this. So very pointed responses there. And as India makes that point on the global stage, I personally believe that it's time to look inwards. You've won diplomacy on the global stage. Now you need to win the Kashmiri people. And therefore, I do believe that keeping people under detention, for example, especially politicians who have stood by the Indian constitution, who have stood with the Indian state, this to me is the weakest element in the narrative of the state.
Let me go back for a moment, though, to something you've mentioned a few times, which is how this is affecting individual Kashmiris. What did it feel like on the ground, and how did you get in and out of the region during this time?
So as a journalist who's been going to Kashmir for over two decades, I don't want to sound jaded, but as with any conflict reporter, you do get a little bit numbed by curfews and security and barricades and, wires and... It's something perhaps that I'm more accustomed to just because I've been going there for so long. That said, of course, for a reporter to file stories at a time when your phones don't work, I mean, there were trips when I took the evening flight back just so I could come back to Delhi and file a story because there was no other way to do it. I thought that the story had been told in very macro terms. There's a curfew, there's a clampdown, people aren't being able to call whom they love. So what I actually did was I actually followed one person from the airport to his house, met his family, met his neighbors. And I found out in the course of talking to him that his mother suffered from chronic diabetes and he had not been able to speak to her for 15 days. And he kind of told me, his voice sort of quivering, that I don't even know if she's alive or dead. And like, I just kept thinking the worst in my mind. And then, we discovered that he was supposed to be married this year, the same man. And he basically had not been able to get in touch with his to-be wife's family, and they didn't think that in such an environment a marriage was possible. So really it was important to understand this anxiety and this anguish through one family. And then I went to a center where phone helplines. So what the administration did was, because all phone lines were snapped, they set up helplines for people who wanted to make calls. But obviously there was a demand supply mismatch, right? So you had these serpentine lines of people and they had little slips of paper in their hand with their serial number trying to make phone calls, and then they would sometimes make a call and it would say not reachable, and they would come out in tears with this little piece of paper that said not reachable, and that not reachable were the most, the dreaded two words that nobody wanted to hear. So those are the stories one's been trying to, in a sense, report, while not forgetting the larger geopolitical complexities that I think a lot of Indians feel that the Western media doesn't understand or ignores or overlooks. So there is that kind of angst right now with a lot of the Western media as well.
Do you have a sense of what the average Kashmiri, if there is such a thing, or average person in Jammu or Kashmir want? Do they want independence? Do they want to become an autonomous state? What do they want?
Where you go in Jammu and Kashmir will evoke a different answer to this question. I also think if you push people on, when you say, even those who say we want Azadi, which is the Urdu word for freedom, if you push them on this and then you ask them to define it, it's not necessarily well thought through. There is obviously a section of people who, as I said, are secessionists, and that sentiment is of secessionism, of secession from India. But I think there are also a number of people, like I said, I've met worker after worker who's actually, I've met families where workers have died and been killed by militants, just to defend the kind of the flag of India. Similarly, the police officers, here's the irony, the police officers who are in charge right now are also Kashmiris. So there are many different sentiments here. And there is also the question of, are people really telling you what they freely think? Because there is a shadow of the gun in any conversation that takes place in an insurgency of 30 years. And then there are regional and religious disparities as well. My answer to you would be slightly different. My answer would be, there is no government in India that is going to ever. I mean, I don't speak for any political party, but I speak as somebody who's been a journalist now for more than two decades. And I can say this, that with absolute certainty, that there is no government in India from any political party that is going to redraw the borders and give away parts of the Kashmir Valley to those who may want to secede from India. So if you accept that as a non-starter, then you have to accept that any practical long-term solution has to be within the framework of the Indian constitution. And it doesn't matter who you ask this to, what party wins in India, that is the political reality. India will go to war with Pakistan again and again if it has to defend that bottom line. So if everything works backwards from that bottom line, then I believe that today more than ever before, what we as citizens or what we in the media should be urging the government to do is to uphold that constitution and to uphold the civil liberties that that constitution promises to all citizens, which is why my focus is less on 370, because it's going to take us time to figure out what the impact of that is going to be. My focus would be more on the restoration of civil liberties. And even if you see the global response, the world isn't telling India what to do with Article 370. The world has accepted that this is an internal matter of India. But I think that to continue sort of, you know, thousands under arrest without any clarity on why they've been arrested, this does not behove to me a confident democracy.
I have one other question that we haven't addressed, which is that you've mentioned militancy and you've mentioned violence on the part of insurgency, but there was also, or there has been over the last decade at least, great deal of anger amidst the Kashmiri public over the use of pellet guns by the Indian security forces and injuries when there have been mass protests. Is there some answer to that as well on the use of force by Indian security forces in the region?
So I think this has been an ongoing debate in India, in the Indian media, in the Indian parliament even. And the time that pellet guns were used in an extreme sort of way was in fact in 2016, which I mentioned, when the militant was eliminated and there were street protests which turned violent and you had protesters with stones and the security forces responded with, you know, these iron pellets that caused partial or in some cases complete blindings. And at that time, I remember doing a series of reports on it and the Indian parliament actually getting up and saying, we need a different standard operating procedure. We need to see what replacements we can find for these guns. So it's not that these discussions have not taken place and are not taking place. But here's the point. What happens is, it is precisely this that will then be used by the administration to say, so isn't it better if we actually have no protests? I'm not saying I agree with this, but I'm trying to give you a glimpse into how they're thinking.
You mentioned this earlier, that India and Pakistan will go to war again and again over Kashmir. Why is Kashmir that flashpoint between these two countries?
So, I mean, the fact is that it doesn't mean that India would not go to war with Pakistan over some other part of the country if Pakistan were, you know, invested in it or meddling in it. But I think the historical complexity of this is what explains it.
During these information blackouts and the curfews, do Kashmiris stockpile food? How do they conduct their day-to-day life?
So the administration tried to say that essential supplies would not be affected. But of course, you also have to understand that this is not the first time that Kashmiris are actually seeing this kind of crackdown. And I kind of would even say that the moment internet lines go down, you know that you're in for a sort of prolonged period of trouble. But certainly despite that, there have been harrowing tales of, you know, somebody saying I couldn't reach the hospital on time, or my sister, you know, there's a very, very moving report in the Indian Express of a woman who had a miscarriage because they weren't able to call the doctor and get kind of immediate help on the phone. And also, why, you know, our lives have changed. Technology has changed our lives. We've become so accustomed to being able to pick up the phone and call and conduct a lot of our lives on the phone, right? But I think the administration has kept essential services, essential supplies exempt. So, for example, when I was there, I did see pharmacies open. But the point is that pharmacies are allowed to be open. But sometimes, because nobody wants trouble, they'll keep the shop open for 2 hours and they themselves will go and shut the shutter and go away. It's because people are also participating. Maybe sometimes some people are showing their anger. Some people are showing their fear. Some people just say, okay, it's not a good time. So because of a combination of reasons, the city and the valley will have to be eased back. And it will not be eased back till it's a kind of chicken and egg thing. Like, one of these things has to happen first. You know, maybe some people will be released. Maybe some steam will be let off. Maybe if there's a protest and the protest goes off peacefully, then maybe the phone lines will be open. The phone lines are open. Maybe the shops will be open. You know, shopkeepers will be more willing to sort of take a chance on any sort of, you know, perceived normalcy in the situation.
Thank you so much. I appreciate your time. Thank you so
thank
much.
You. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay,
thank you.
Bye.
That was Barkha Dutt. She's an Indian broadcast journalist who has covered Kashmir over the last 20 years and spent much of August shuttling back and forth to the region. First Person is produced by me, Sarah Wildman, along with help from Maya Gandhi and Benjamin Soloway. Our editor is Rob Sachs, and our executive editor for news and podcasts is Dan Efron. If you like this episode, please subscribe. We'll be back next Friday.